You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
I'm Tristan Carcino.
And this week, it's all about the San Francisco 49ers in the NFC Championship game.
But I have to, before any of that, mention the shirt that you're wearing.
You have to.
I was at an event last night, and Brian Robinson of Save Our Sonics fame came up to me. He knows me as Kevin Pelton's brother. I think he might not know what my name is. Came up to me and said, "Did you see the shirt that Kevin posted on Facebook?" And I had no idea what he was talking about. There was kind of an awkward moment.
No.
And then I went home and saw this. Do you want to explain it to the listening audience?
Well, I also had an event last night, getting together to do a belated Christmas gift exchange with some friends. And the person who drew my name gave me a customized t-shirt that with a series of hashtags.
Uh-huh.
So on the front is, "I'm kind of a big deal."
Uh-huh.
This is all playing off my giant ego.
It really is. And then, there's a podcast named with your last name.
Well, that is true. We totally cut you out of the podcast. And that does.
I'm just Kevin Pelton's brother.
I don't know.
Do you want me to read
the
those?
Ones on the back?
There's
the highlights.
Hashtag, I write for ESPN. Hashtag, I publish books. Hashtag, I have 20,000 followers. Which I was thinking, if you get in the future, get to something like, you know, 50,000, if you really blow up on Twitter, how quaint that will seem. Hashtag, I'm famous at Oscars, the bar owned by Sean Kemp. Is that true?
No, that's where we were last night, and I would not describe myself as that famous.
People don't yell your name when you come in? Hashtag, I get low when I dance.
That's probably the best inside joke of the group, and I'm glad that that's going out there for the whole world to see.
You get low when you dance? That's not anything that I've ever seen before.
You haven't seen me dance when I've been really into dancing.
So. I want to see this.
There may be a certain correlation with having a lot to drink. And
then you're
really
getting low?
That's the one move I have, since I'm an awkward white guy dancer.
You've got a move?
That's, I mean,
and that's it?
The thing is, I barely remember the move.
Oh, I want to see this.
The
oh, man. There should have been a Vine video taken of that. That's what Vine was invented for.
It's too dark. You really can't see anything.
Oh, to see you getting low, 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 low.
I've tried.
Uh-huh. Boots with the fur. and your
shirt. Don't even have a good photo of my friend grinding with Sean Kemp at Oscars one time.
Really?
Yeah.
There's dancing at Oscars?
On weekends, it becomes club Oscars sometimes.
Oh, really? And Sean Kemp goes out there and dances?
Occasionally.
Is everybody trying to dance with Sean Kemp when this happens?
I mean, I'm not particularly.
I would be.
I mean, there is a certain concern that you could get pregnant just from dancing.
Yeah.
But that might be cool with some people, so.
So anyway, your shirt tested really well on Facebook.
It really did.
I mean, it's so well that Brian Robinson came up to me at a completely different event and brought it up to me, to Kevin Pelton's brother.
I've heard it's actually a bigger deal now than the Seahawks 49ers game.
That's really also funny, because one of my friends who was with was saying, it was a good thing that you called him that, because Tristan is just like, he thinks he's this cool guy in the music industry. And then he came over, and you're like, "Oh, hey, it's Kevin Pelton's brother." So she thought that was really great. That tested really well.
A lot of people like making fun of our giant egos. That's what we've learned here.
So anyway, turn our attention to football. This last week, obviously, the Seahawks advanced over the Saints. And we talked about that in a post-game recap, so probably won't talk about that game very much.
No, just in the context of what it portends for this week.
In general, I think that there's kind of a new, the term was Fateful Four last week, and I think there's kind of a new Fateful Four this week.
Yeah, someone actually used that term I saw.
Really?
Not Fateful Four, they said Fated Four.
Fated Four.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, I should have trademarked that.
Yeah. Should put it on a t-shirt.
But
Mike Tannier on Sports
really?
On Earth.
There you
the
go.
Fated Four.
But Denver and New England, two teams who are probably in the AFC, are favored before the season.
Yep.
And then San Francisco and Seattle, who preseason in Vegas were favored in every single game except for the ones that they played at each other's home stadium.
Yep.
So I think it's really exciting, and it means that there's not going to be a team in the Super Bowl, which we can talk about now since it's only one game away. there's
we
not
can't really look ahead to it at this point.
There's not going to be a team in the Super Bowl who I would say doesn't belong there. Basically, whoever the champion is this year and whoever the two teams are that play in the Super Bowl, it's going to be a really competitive game, and it's going to be really exciting to come up against one of those teams.
No, I mean, both in a 2013-2014 perspective and then also kind of a global perspective. You know, we've talked in the past about Denver and Seattle repeated 1-2 in Football Outsiders DVOA. San Francisco was in the Super Bowl last year, and obviously New England, the run of success they've had. These are teams that have been good for a long period of time.
And there's a lot of synergy between all four of the teams. So whatever the matchup ends up being, obviously I know what I want it to be, but whatever the matchup ends up being, it'll be an exciting Super Bowl. I may just not have to watch it.
I mean, you can't not watch it, but yes, it would be very painful.
Having a two-week break, if the Seahawks were to lose on Sunday, having a two-week break would be nice.
Not an experience we've ever experienced, since the only time they've lost in the championship game was...
The Pro Bowl. We'll treat that as our Super Bowl. Like if Russell Wilson gets player of the game in the Pro Bowl, you drive that car out of there.
It was kind of like that last year a little bit.
It was kind of like that last year. But I want to talk a little bit later about the AFC and who we would want to win if the Seahawks were to win. Maybe after we talk about the Seahawks 49ers game. But breaking down the 49ers, let's start with the 49ers on offense, and let's start with Colin Kaepernick, who seems to be kind of the most divisive player in the 49ers right now.
Well, he might be the most divisive player in the NFL, first off. But he's also...
Now that Tebow's gone.
Yeah. He's also the most important, and, you know, I think Bill Simmons described it well, that if you're scared if you gamble against him, you're scared if you gamble on him. And I think that's a good way to describe it, because Kaepernick, when he's on, is as good as anyone, and when he's off, he's often really, really off.
And so you reviewed the last couple of games that the Seahawks and the 49ers played against each other, and obviously we watched the game against Carolina on Sunday. What were some things that you saw there from Kaepernick?
Well, I think one thing that people forget, obviously Kaepernick has had two really horrendous games in Seattle as a starter, but even in this year's game, he was actually pretty effective as a runner. He had 9 carries for 87 yards in that game. And, you know, the Seahawks really played a lot of coverage, especially after they built a big lead, and were willing to sacrifice him running in order to try to take away the big play in the passing game. And so that'll be interesting to see, something to watch and see if it continues. He can definitely make plays if you lose contain and lose discipline in your passing lanes. He can tuck it down and make a big play with his feet.
And I think that's something, I mean, the Seahawks are definitely doing this intentionally, and I think it's something that will continue for this game. They're willing to give Colin Kaepernick a few yards running the ball.
They're not going to spy him.
And this was coming off the first game that they played in Seattle. He had 9 carries for 87 yards. So obviously he had a good game running. But this was coming off the game against Green Bay, where they were so focused on Colin Kaepernick running the ball that he was able to pass the ball to Anquan Boldin easily that entire game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that there may be some plays for him in the read option. And then the other thing we obviously saw in the last game with Kaepernick as a runner was the power run to the left on 3rd and 7 that won them the game, basically.
Honestly, I think that was the only play that Colin Kaepernick had running the ball that really affected the outcome of the game. It ended the game, so obviously it affected the game, but he ran the ball a lot in that game. He only had 9 carries for 31 yards, but they were willing to give him 5 yards.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's a comfortable trade-off.
And I think that if he hadn't had that run, there would be no concern whatsoever. Now, because of that, it's something that the Seahawks have to pay a little bit more attention to this week, because they can't allow him on a 3rd and long to pick it up on the ground.
And I think the big thing to watch there is the way that the Seahawks' defensive personnel lines up. So I went and watched that play several times on the All-22 film, and what happened was San Francisco had 3 receivers to the right, 2 receivers to the left. And so the Seahawks' entire defense was shaded towards the right side of the offensive side of the football. So you've got the pass rush was slanting that way. There was 3 defenders covering that group of 3 receivers and only two defenders on the other side. And basically San Francisco just saw the numbers and knew that they could pull that off. Now, Earl Thomas was the one guy who had kind of a shot at it, didn't take a great angle at it, and kind of was taken out of the play. It's interesting, against Carolina, they ran it a couple of times. They didn't run a power run, but they ran the same sort of thing where they just had the numbers in their favor near the goal line for one of their touchdowns. But there was another time they ran the exact same play, the power run on like 3rd and 7, and Carolina snuffed that out with defensive penetration from the line.
And I mean, you would probably assume that Carolina's defensive line is better than Seattle's defensive line.
Yeah.
Should be able to get through there easier. What about Colin Kaepernick? So you mentioned that you felt like he was making a lot of mistakes in the games that you watched. Looking at him, though, statistically, he has less fumbles than Russell Wilson has and less interceptions than Russell Wilson has. And we kind of consider Russell Wilson the peak of efficiency and the peak of holding onto the ball.
Well, the fumbles certainly are something that do not fit into the general Russell Wilson narrative and how he is overall a player. But, you know, I think what it is when Wilson throws an interception, you can see what he was looking for. Kaepernick, sometimes you're just like, what on earth were you thinking? I mean, the pick he threw to Byron Maxwell in the game at San Francisco, you know, the Seahawks had safety help. Maxwell was in perfect position. There was no reason for him to throw that football, and if he was going to throw it, he had to throw it, basically put it on the receiver's back shoulder on the sideline where he was the only one who could make a play on it. Instead, he kind of lofts it up, and Maxwell comes up with an interception in the red zone that really helped the Seahawks.
Now, he's less accurate than Russell Wilson, but I think that what the 49ers do, basically the 49ers and the Seahawks, and I guess probably the Broncos, do this better. The four teams left, really, they pass to the right places better than any other team in the league. Right? They're not throwing the ball over the middle. What they do with Colin Kaepernick is they have the receivers out wide, and he's always throwing toward the sideline. And I think that's what really limits his interceptions and what limits the turnovers that Colin Kaepernick has, because they're having him throw the ball to places where only his receivers can get to it. He might not be accurate throwing there. He might overthrow his receivers sometimes, but there's not going to be a chance for the other team to make a play on it.
Yeah, and I think that also they're very good against zone defenses. We see Anquan Boldin is very good at finding the seams
of the
zone.
That's the one time that they really go over the middle, is playing against zone defenses.
And so we probably won't see much of that from the Seahawks. I don't anticipate with Crabtree back that we'll see the kind of Sherman shadowing Boldin that we saw in the first game up here. That wasn't the case even in the game down in San Francisco.
That'll be interesting to talk about. I mean, with Sherman basically being taken out of the game against the Saints last week, he didn't record anything. He didn't record a deflection, a tackle, nothing at all. It was as if Richard Sherman wasn't even playing in the game, but the Saints didn't throw to his side of the field. It'll be interesting to see if the Seahawks do move him around a little bit more just to create some confusion with the 49ers, because right now you can't have the 49ers game planning that we're just not going to go to this side. We're only going to pick on Byron Maxwell. I don't think the Seahawks can allow that to happen.
I don't think they mind if the San Francisco takes an entire side of the field out of their game plan. I think that's a win for the Seahawks.
I mean, that might play into what the Seahawks want to do, in that they're saying, okay, you're only going to play with 2/3 of the field.
Yeah, and you're taking, I mean, in the Saints case, they took Jimmy Graham out of the game a lot of the time because that way they were using him to, you know, take Sherman. He is kind of a decoy.
I just can't imagine a situation where, I mean, I know that the 49ers are not going to throw at Sherman. The last time they played, they went out of their way not to throw the ball toward Richard Sherman.
I think that's overstated a little bit. I mean, Boldin did have a catch against Sherman, and then also Sherman had a defensive holding at one point, which obviously you don't have to be throwing his way, but that to me was one of the big storylines in that game. Three defensive holdings on the Seahawks secondary, one on Sherman, two on Maxwell, and I think that there is a pretty direct correlation between that and Jim Harbaugh's constant harping to the media harbaugh to this media on the way the Seahawks play defense, and we're obviously going to see that again. And you know, one of the biggest factors in this game that it's going to come down to me is how it's called.
I don't see it happening here. In the playoffs in Seattle, I don't see something like that happening. I think Gene Steratore is a great ref, too. I was really excited when I saw that Gene Steratore.
Oh, absolutely. Very good choice. And, you know, I think both him, I would have been happy with either of the refs this weekend.
But I don't see them calling close defensive holdings or close defensive pass interferences.
We'll see. I mean,
they allow you to get away with more in the playoffs, you know?
It's true, but at some point, if there's so much talk about you get away with more in the playoffs, that may cause people to tighten up. And I think we saw that San Francisco-Carolina game was called pretty tight in the first half.
Yeah.
Other than Anquan Boldin can apparently headbutt people, but when you headbutt him, it's a 15-yard penalty.
It could be. I mean, there was kind of part of the talk where when Harbaugh got the penalty coming out, that referees are targeting Jim Harbaugh and know that he's doing this.
So it's both sides are targeted.
Everybody's targeted.
It's great.
But the conversation was that they probably before the game told Jim Harbaugh, don't come onto the field. If you come on the field, you're going to get flagged.
I mean, I'd be surprised if they had that specific of a conversation. You're really not supposed to come onto the field that far at any point.
But they do allow it in other situations and don't flag coaches. In this particular one, I think that it wouldn't have happened if it weren't Jim Harbaugh.
No, where you're storming out and pointing at the clock to a referee who isn't even the person in charge of determining whether there's a replay. I mean, at the very least, it could have been a delay of game for a situation where, you know, if you throw the red flag, challenge flag in that scenario where you can't challenge, that's a delay of game.
So what about, I want to move on to Frank Gore in a second in their run game, but what about Colin Kaepernick and the way that this has to be by design? The 49ers are coming to the line with very few seconds left on the play clock.
If it's by design, it's not a good design. I do not endorse it.
How do you think, I was thinking that this might be part of the reason that Colin Kaepernick is worse at CenturyLink Field, and that's why the noise probably affects him more than a lot of other quarterbacks. Because if you're coming to the line with 2 or 3 seconds left on the play clock, or maybe a little bit more than that, 5 to 6 seconds left on the play clock, and you don't have, you can't hear what's going on, and you don't have any time to adjust a play, you're running way more frantic than if you have 10, 15 seconds to be able to settle yourself.
It's a valid hypothesis. It's a weird thing, like, you know, I don't know whether it's Kaepernick, I don't know whether it's, you know, Greg Roman, or the coaching staff. I mean, it doesn't make any sense why they're consistently so late out of the huddle into the line of scrimmage, and it's nearly cost them in Green Bay with the early timeouts they took, and I think that timeout management could be a major factor in this game.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. They also don't control the time of possession. I had a theory that maybe the 49ers are masking some of their deficiencies by just dominating time of possession every game. And the one looked at it throughout the season, and they've had a lower time of possession than their opponents often.
Yeah, I mean, it's... And it's not like... It's not like they're trying to hide their defense or something, so it'd be a weird scenario for that to be a strategy. I mean, you want to control the football, but you want to control the football by running more plays, not by just taking more time between them.
And then let's look at the ground game, Frank Gore and Kendall Hunter. Gore has been slowing down a little bit this last season.
Was he slowing down in that run?
He's become kind of a boomer bust runner. You know, in that Seahawks game, they bottled him up all game, and then he had this one big run. And it was a similar thing that happened against Carolina last week, both with him and Hunter, that they had one big run that kind of made it a good game for them, but most of the game they were picking up 2-3 yards.
I think the thing that stands out to me watching Frank Gore on tape is he's really good at squeezing through small holes. And you see, like, this scrum, and then all of a sudden, boom, he pops out of it. And it's not necessarily, you know, a 40-yard run like that, but it's how he turns what should be a 2 or 3 yard run into a 6 or 7 yard run. I still think he's very good. I think he runs as hard as anyone in the league, not named Marshawn Lynch. And, of course, the history of Frank Gore is that he has destroyed the Seattle Seahawks.
So the last 2 years, it's been kind of different. There's been a pretty massive, as there's been with this rivalry in this game, a massive home-road split.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, two close games, both won by the 49ers at Candlestick, and two blowouts in the Seahawks' favor here at CenturyLink Field. But in the road games, he's carried 33 times for 241 yards combined, which is pretty consistent with his career track record against the Seahawks. He's run for more yards against the Seahawks than any other team now. Obviously, part of that is being in the NFC West his entire career, yeah. But he's run for more yards against the Seahawks than Arizona or St. Louis, who's faced a similar number
of
times.
It's hard to determine who I hate more. Between Frank Gore and Colin Kaepernick. Colin Kaepernick is a newfound hate, but Frank Gore I've hated for years.
I mean, he just, like, the monsoon game in Seattle and all sorts of games in San Francisco, there are so many bad memories of Frank Gore just destroying the Seahawks on the draft. But Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson would remind you not to hate your opponents and to respect them. And I think you may need to study the guide to the win forever philosophy that our friend Damon Agnes
sent
along. Well, it didn't stick, apparently. Because you're not respecting everyone.
I was saying, can I respect somebody and hate them at the same time?
I mean,
I respect Jim Harbaugh, but I hate him more than any coach in the history of the NFL.
Pete Carroll may allow some hate into his heart. But respect, Russell Wilson would not ever
respect
enjoy.
Respect and hatred are completely different things.
It's valid, but again, I think that as Seahawks fans, we need to look to our leaders and recognize the way that they would love even their enemies.
I respect your enemies. There's not part of the pyramid is not love your enemies.
That's more of a Russell Wilson thing, I think. I mean,
you need to respect your enemy. But you can also dislike them at the same time. We had an argument about this over Google Talk earlier. And I was saying that I need to hate as a fan who's going to be at this game, I need to hate Colin Kaepernick and Frank Gore and the rest of the 49ers to be able to cheer as loud as I can. It's my responsibility. Be respectful and don't say potentially racist, homophobic things about them.
That's always preferable.
But, I mean, in any situation, that should be the case. But also, I need to hate them to be able to cheer as loud as possible.
I think that you cheer out of love for your team, not hatred for the opponent. That's the way I view it.
You just can't work up as loud cheering out of love for your team.
Do you think that I'm cheering insufficiently at Husky games?
And you love all the opponents? You love Oregon? Do you cheer louder when it's against Oregon?
It's a bigger game. I mean, like, you know, the Colorado and Cal games this year, it's not like I was going in there, like, fired up, like, gonna make a difference today. Like, you know, it's a little, or the Idaho State game or something, but...
But coming back to the San Francisco running game, I think this is the most important part for the Seattle defense. Against the Saints, they didn't play particularly well against the run, and it opened things up in the second half for Drew Brees.
Well, I guess we never finished the stat. So 33 carries for 241 yards in the two games at Candlestick. The two games in Seattle the last 2 years, 15 carries for 44 yards. So not only they shut him down, especially in the first meeting this year where he, I think, had less than 2 yards a carry, but the bigger difference is 33 carries versus 15. And I don't want to get all run to win on you, but because, you know, one controls the other. But what I think we see is that if you can get an early lead against the 49ers and shut them down on the run game and make them one-dimensional, that's where the difference is between these close games in San Francisco and these blowouts in Seattle.
Absolutely.
That they don't have to honor the threat of the run.
Yeah, absolutely. And the secondary, if the secondary can key in on just the pass, they're going to be amazing against it. If they don't have to worry about anything else and can have all the Legion of Boom back there ready, they're going to be, and they're already the best pass defense in the league, but if they're the pass...
Not the best pass defense in the league. One of the two best pass defenses in the last 20 or 30 years.
So if they're the second best pass defense of all time, and they're playing against a one-dimensional team, then that's a pretty scary thought.
I mean, a couple other things. First off, the 49ers, much like the Seahawks, love using play action to set up their passing game, especially kind of the quick hitters to Bolden or Crabtree or even Vernon Davis. That's something they use a lot. So you take that away if the run game is not a factor for them. Another thing we should discuss, one of the biggest differences in terms of personnel from the last game on the defensive side of the field, Bruce Miller out for the 49ers. He played 43 of the 68 snaps in the last meeting between these two teams, had two big third down pickups, and they've gotten good production from Anthony Dixon as sort of the runner and Will Chukwuafu, who's a former Seahawk when he played defensive end.
I've never heard of him.
Tukuafu left Sunday's game after he had his ankle.
I've heard of him since then, but I had never heard of him before
that. That was the first time for me, too. So he may not be able to play, in which case they don't really have the blocking fullback. They used Vance McDonald, their backup tight end, a little bit in that role, but that could affect their running game.
Do you think they'd go more often to two tight ends if that were the scenario?
Probably, yeah.
And not have the lead fullback. That definitely could be a factor.
But Dixon played a lot in that game.
The cutbacks for the Saints, though, were not necessarily driven because of fullback play.
It's true.
I think they were moving the line in one way, and Ingram was able to go through the holes the other way.
And nobody is better at that cutback run than Gore.
So I think that's going to be the key to the game. I think that that's going to be the most important thing for the Seahawks defense to stop.
How important do you think it is whether KJ Wright plays?
I don't think it matters either way.
I think it matters a little bit.
You're talking about KJ Wright. You're talking about the options are either Malcolm Smith having played in practice for about a month straight or KJ Wright coming back after not playing for over a month.
I think KJ Wright's physical tools are superior, and Smith had a bit of a tough time against the run on Saturday. I mean, I don't think that was the only reason. I mean, the Seahawks shut down St. Louis with him in there.
Started playing with the team, yeah. They were playing fine against the run. You know, didn't have any problems at all.
I mean...
The game on Sunday against the Saints was the worst they played against the run since Tampa Bay weeks ago.
Yes, but I was surprised when I went back and looked at the stats that the run defense wasn't as good in the second half of the season as I thought it was. San Francisco, I mean, obviously the Gore run was a big part of that, but they had some success.
And that was
ground.
Not because of KJ Wright or Malcolm Smith.
No.
And that play. What about the 49ers, their receivers?
They're better than they were at the start of the season.
They are. I mean, Anquan Boldin is having probably the best year of his entire career. He's been amazing this year. And I think having Crabtree come back has meant that he's getting even more separation than he was getting before Crabtree was around.
I mean, I don't think people realize how good they are as a team passing the football. They're up to fourth in passing DVOA this year, which is really incredible for a team that doesn't, you don't think of is in the same class as Denver and San Diego and New Orleans.
They don't pass the ball very often.
Yeah, that's part of it.
They're very efficient when they do pass the ball, but it's not happening very much. The Seahawks are a really similar team like that also.
Except that they're better in the run game. That's the big difference between them. Is on a per-play basis, the 49ers have actually been fairly average running the ball overall.
And the Seahawks are better in the run game. It's one of the places where the two teams are separated from very similar teams. And then also the pass defense is the one place. So it's one place that the advantage goes to the Seahawks. I think that Crabtree coming back means that you can't do something like they did in the first game where Sherman just shadowed Anquan Boldin the whole game and shut him down.
No.
It is kind of the main thing. I think Byron Maxwell's played really well, but the Saints did target Byron Maxwell last week, and I think I would expect to see a lot of Boldin going against Maxwell.
I mean, would you say they were effective in doing that? I mean, most of what they hit was, I feel like, against zones.
It's a complicated thing when you look at it statistically because they were so successful in the second half in the last few drives passing the ball. That it's hard to really break it down when everything was happening without watching every single play again. But
it felt like the only thing they specifically hit against Maxwell was the tip pass.
Yeah. I mean, they definitely weren't successful in doing that. But they're going to target Maxwell, and they're going to target Maxwell with Boldin.
Yeah, I mean, we can't be surprised by that, certainly.
I think that safety-wise, I think they'll really be able to take Vernon Davis out of the game. I think the one thing is just making sure that... And I think they'll be able to take Crabtree out of the game also. And I think it might actually end up being really similar to what they did last week against Carolina and San Francisco, where nobody else really factored statistically, but Anquan Boldin had 8 catches for 136 yards.
Yeah, and Vernon Davis had 2 catches for 21 yards in the last meeting, fairly quiet game. Crabtree had 4 for 40, but Boldin was definitely the main target, 6 for 93.
And the Seahawks have generally been good against Vernon Davis.
I mean, the other thing is, those were the only 3 guys who caught passes other than Bruce Miller. So... There was a lot of Quinton Patton, I think, as a third or fourth receiver in that Carolina game, but just not a big factor getting him the football. And if Tukuafu does play, the pass he caught where he got injured on Sunday, his first career catch.
He's not a real big threat. He got injured on his first career catch.
That was kind of rough for him. That was disappointing.
I feel like there needs to be a Reddit meme about that. So let's look at the Seahawks offense now going against the San Francisco defense. San Francisco has a good defense, but they're not in that elite level that the Seahawks are in, and honestly, with a lot of the defenses that they've faced lately.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the surprise is that they're not as good as New Orleans, who people think of as this offense-first team, still have that stereotype of them.
It feels relieving, right? Playing against San Francisco, Pro Football Outsiders, they're ranked 13th, and New Orleans is ranked 10th. It's something where I think they might actually be able to get something going a little bit more than they have been able to in a lot of weeks. There's been a lot of talk, and we mentioned this last week, and it kind of continued with Russell Wilson having struggles, and Russell Wilson did miss some passes. I'm going to chalk that up to the wind and chalk that up to the elements and chalk that up to New Orleans being a pretty damn good defensive team.
And I think the fourth factor is that it's difficult for people to recognize how much harder it is to get into a rhythm as a quarterback when you're throwing the ball 18 times as opposed to Andrew Luck throwing it 40 times a game. That's a really different experience because one or two throws, especially because they're all on third down, one or two throws is the difference between having a good day and a bad day.
So San Francisco does, they let things go. They're 14th against the run and 10th against the pass. I actually think in this week coming up, maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more in predictions, but I think that the Seahawks are going to pass the ball really effectively against San Francisco. It looks like Carlos Rogers, their star cornerback, is going to play this week, who was out last week against Carolina.
That'll help considerably. I still think they're going to try to start by establishing.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's Pete Carroll. He's always going to start by establishing the run unless he's really convinced that that's what you're expecting. Lynch had a couple of long runs in that San Francisco game that got brought back on holding, kind of similar to the Turbin run last week that got brought back. So it'd be interesting to see whether those opportunities are still there or whether it was strictly a product of the hold.
And whether those holding calls, because those were both really close calls, in that San Francisco game. Honestly, when we talk about the penalties in that game, I think that obviously the players felt this, Richard Sherman in particular, but I think we felt this also, that it looked like the offense was playing really good, or not looked like, the offense played really good against San Francisco. They just had things brought back that put them in these situations with eight drives or whatever, where three of the drives they're in a first and 20 or second and 20 situation.
Now, we talked about the Seahawks not allowing Kaepernick to run. This opposite is not true. Russell Wilson in the last game had one carry for 2 yards. They really tried to stay home and not give him the opportunity to scramble. But then also, in the read option, if you watch them, and this was true against Carolina as well, they are very concerned with having the quarterback hand off the football. And in the last game, every time they ran it, Marshawn got the football. He had 8 carries for 32 yards in read option plays.
And they were shadowing Russell that entire game, and shadowing Cam Newton also. It's something where if Russell gets anything going on the ground, it's going to be a major mistake for San Francisco. They're going to be really upset about it. He'll have to escape a defender, or make some sort of crazy play that there's a lot of room in front of him, or get around the person who's shadowing him. But they're going to make sure that Russell does not run the ball.
And that obviously opens up other things. So the big thing that it opened up in the last game was the read option fake.
Yeah.
When the Seahawks used that as play action, they were 3 of 3 throwing the ball for 37 yards.
And this could be a huge thing if Percy Harvin plays also.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we saw a glimpse of this against New Orleans, the kind of possibilities that you can force the defense to account for. Football Outsiders had a nice breakdown using film of his impact on the game. And one of the things they pointed out was the Marshawn Lynch touchdown run off a read option came out of the same formation that earlier the Seahawks had thrown the kind of wide receiver bubble screen to Harvin out of.
I thought it was an interesting thing. At first, it seemed like the Seahawks were forcing it to Harvin on that first play, or the second play of the game when they threw that bubble screen. But then it kind of seemed like, okay, they're intentionally forcing it to him in this one play. They're giving it up this one time to make the defense think that they're going to be running that often. It's actually kind of an interesting thing. I mean, you would want Percy Harvin, 100% he's going to play. But just the factor of him looming, whether he may play or not, it means that San Francisco has to prepare as if he's going to play.
Absolutely. They have to be ready for the variety of different options we saw. Now, the one thing I wonder about is whether there is, if Percy Harvin isn't practicing this week, which seems unlikely that he'll be at anywhere close to full strength if he is able to practice, whether you put in some of those similar things for a different player. Because he's a unique talent, but you got to have something more creative on third down than the series of slants we saw last Saturday. That's not going to cut it.
It's true. I mean, if they would have hit one or two of those, things might have been different. I think that the elements affected that.
But that's not really the Seahawks' fortes in the passing game anyway.
But I also think they were probably expecting to have, they were preparing as if they were going to have Percy for that entire game, with things prepared for that. And then when he went out, it kind of shrunk the playbook that they were expecting to have. And I think maybe there was some panic that happened there. But I think that having Percy around and looming means that they still have those plays that they had last week, and I think that they didn't unveil everything, you know? It actually meant that him not playing the whole time means that the 49ers didn't get the game plan as thoroughly as they would have liked to.
That's probably true. I mean, I think there's layers on a lot of these package plays. If you take away one thing, we go to the second thing, and then you take away that, and then we go to the third thing.
But I
and
don't see them
putting somebody... We saw a couple levels of that, I think, but not all the levels.
Exactly. And I don't see them putting somebody like Golden Tate or Doug Baldwin in that same situation.
But just even like a wide receiver screen to Golden Tate, we haven't seen much of that lately. Now, obviously, part of it is he's a really good blocker, so you'd like to have him leading the way in that.
I don't see them running a fly sweep with Doug Baldwin.
No, I definitely don't see. But the other thing we need to see on Sunday is the tight ends more involved with the passing game. And that was there against San Francisco the last time, especially off play action. Luke Wilson had 3 catches for 70 yards and a touchdown. It was his best game of the season.
I could definitely see them getting Wilson. I mean, he's coming back another week from injury, so I'll have more time to get healthy. But I could see him and Miller getting involved in the passing game a lot.
And the other thing I noticed that could be a factor, the Seahawks were able to do this, and then Carolina did it last week with Brandon LaFell, is when you motion the wide receiver into the backfield and then have it so where it's where it looks like that they're going to set a crack back block. I don't know why I can't say that word, but apparently I can't. Anyway, it looks like they're going to do that, and instead they kind of sneak out the opposite direction like a tight end would, yep. And the Seahawks will probably do that at some point with Jermaine Kearse.
Yeah, and I think when you're talking about running fake or play action read options, and how they're following Russell Wilson so much, that means that you're giving up something there, and what they're giving up is those tight ends.
Absolutely.
So I think Russell will be able to hit them, be able to roll out and hit them, and make big plays from that.
So I think the last question mark about the Seahawks on offense is how well they can handle the San Francisco pressure. I mean, as you mentioned, they haven't been great at getting to the quarterback this year defensively, but Alden Smith is a dangerous weapon.
It's a weird thing. It depends on how much you value what has happened for the entire season or what has happened for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, which I think a lot of this matchup is.
Are the playoffs so important and playing well in the playoffs so important that you just judge what's going on right now? Or do you look at the entire season and say, okay, this is the same team? Throughout the season, they're 29th in adjusted sack rate from Football Outsiders. They're 18th in total sacks throughout the season. But in the playoffs, they have 9 sacks, including 5 last week against Carolina.
Yeah, and that's a huge difference, especially with the Seahawks' offensive line being as weak as it has been all season.
I'm gonna use some non-statistical things to explain this away.
Okay.
So for week one against Green Bay, this is San Francisco. Week one against Green Bay, San Francisco owns that team.
They do.
Green Bay is out of their minds when they think about San Francisco. They cannot play against them.
They've got them on tilt.
Yeah. And then the following week, I mean, they destroyed, and especially Green Bay's offensive line, which isn't very good, but they destroyed Green Bay with 4 sacks. The following week, I think Carolina was not ready to play in a playoff game. They were so excited. They were so overwhelmed. Cam Newton was holding onto the ball for way too long in that game, basically giving San Francisco sacks.
I don't know. They played well offensively in the first half. The real trouble started in the second half where he took those couple of back-to-back sacks.
It may have been that he was waiting for Steve Smith to get open, and he wasn't getting as open in the second half.
The other thing I think we saw between the two halves last week is Carolina came up with a lot of new stuff.
Yeah,
they had worked on during the bye week. There was, you know, a variety. They spread San Francisco out a lot. They were trying a variety of different things. And San Francisco was not ready for that in the first half, but they made adjustments and shut it down after halftime.
Yeah, I just really think that Carolina was not ready for this game. I don't think that Cam Newton is ready for this game. That's my non-statistical perspective. And that meant that San Francisco's D-line destroyed them. I mean, this is their third consecutive NFC Championship game. These players have played in a lot of playoff games. They understand what it is. But the Seahawks are now a veteran playoff team.
Yeah, I don't think that they're going to... I don't think it'll be an issue for them. I
mean, Wilson is not going to be overwhelmed out there.
I think the one thing that may be a factor is just kind of the emotions of this rivalry and this matchup. And we saw what kind of barking and extracurriculars there were last week between San Francisco and Carolina. There was a little bit of it between the Saints and the Seahawks, but the Seahawks really did not make mistakes in that regard. And my number one key to this game, I put it in all caps, be the smarter team.
I absolutely agree with you. Be the smarter team in all capacities. Be the smarter team by not overplaying against Frank Gore and letting him run for 60 yards. You know, stay home on those plays. Mm-hmm. Be the smarter team by not getting too obsessed with Colin Kaepernick running the ball.
Be the smarter team by not wasting timeouts early in the half that come back to bite you late in the game.
Absolutely.
I think that in a game that is as potentially close as this is, all those little things start to loom really large. And I think that's, you know, if I have a concern about the Seahawks, it's that maybe they don't match up in that regard. Pete Carroll is not a great clock manager, although it really hasn't been a big problem at any point this season.
No, and I agree that that's going to be a factor, but I think it's going to be a little bit random.
it always is.
You know, I mean, in a lot of the playoff games, clock management has been a huge thing, especially in the first round of the playoffs.
I mean, the difference between good clock management and bad clock management is often luck. I mean, San Francisco used 2 timeouts. I think they were out of timeouts early in the fourth quarter in that Green Bay game.
Yeah.
It just didn't matter because they had the football.
Yeah.
So it could loom large, but in what way, we really have no idea. The other thing that I feel the same way about is special teams. 2 very good special teams this time around facing each other, but in the first meeting, there was... The Seahawks had a blocked punt actually both meetings, come to think of it. The one where they thought they heard a whistle and stopped playing in the first game. The second game was just a clean block by San Francisco. But then also a variety of just weird special teams mistakes by the 49ers in the first game. And in the second game, that was an advantage for them.
Yeah, making sure, being at home, I think, will really help with that. But making sure that they're very steady in the special teams is going to be hugely important. John Ryan's had some pretty bad punts lately also.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, he was notable in that he was punting the ball short against San Francisco. And I don't know if that was concern about the returns or maybe concern about that punt rush and getting blocked again.
Mm-hmm.
Golden Tate did come up with a huge return that could have entirely swung the game had it ended differently.
And this is another place that Percy could be a huge factor also.
Yeah, it's just he's a big difference maker on kickoffs.
But I think Golden Tate's a great punt returner, and it was really nice that that happened in that game also to keep them scared. What else? What do you think are other big factors in this game?
Well, I think the first quarter is a huge factor because of what I talked about earlier. The one thing that stunned me when I went back and looked at that game in Seattle this year between these two teams is it was 5-0 Seahawks at halftime.
That's really interesting.
Well, it was 3 at the end of the third quarter.
That
was still a close game. And then it just, boom, got away from the 49ers in a hurry. And I think the difference between the close games in San Francisco and the blowouts in Seattle is not as large as the point differential would make it seem.
It's true. I agree that getting up early is going to be huge because A, you're taking the running game out of it. B, you're getting the crowd more into it. And C, basically, aside from getting the running game out of it, you're getting the Legion of Boom into the game. You know, you're having them involved on every single play.
Do you think that if the Seahawks struggle early on in offense, that there might start to be some grumbling among the crowd? Like,
I don't think so. I think the crowd will be behind them. It's been a consistent
thing. You mentioned there was some against New Orleans
for a long time that people are a little bit concerned about the offense.
The expectations are out of control.
I don't think that there'll be any grumbling though.
People are
so behind the team for this game. I think that maybe if they're really one-dimensional and they're not trying one thing, let's say that they're running 3 times and not picking up a first down in the first 2 series or something like that, then that might start to happen. But if they're mixing in new things and it's just not working, I don't think there'll be any grumbling. People get concerned when it looks like you're just trying one thing.
They do, but I think part of it is there's some casual Seahawks fans who are not used to the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that the Seahawks have blown out the 49ers the last 2 times they've come here.
Yes.
Why aren't we blowing them out again?
That may be the case.
And that's just not how the playoffs work. That is not how the playoffs work. They're really both really good teams. I do not have a lot of blowouts.
Really hoping that's how the playoffs work.
Well, I mean, yes, I hope so as well. I mean, I think it's a possibility.
If the Seahawks get up early, they could blow out the 49ers in this game.
It could be a similar script, but I think it's more likely it's going to be a close game.
I agree. I don't think, if I have to make some predictions about the game, I think that the Seahawks are going to do really good against the run. Anything that San Francisco gets, I think, is going to be hitting their receivers on these out routes to the sidelines.
I feel differently.
I think that's going to be the place that they get anything.
I think they're going to run the football well, and Kaepernick is going to make some costly mistakes.
Really?
Yeah. I think that's just in his DNA, whether the statistics show it or not. I know what I see when I watch him play.
I think Kaepernick will make mistakes. I think he'll have at least one interception in the game, which is actually, I mean, way more than he's averaging per game throughout the season. I think he'll throw a pick, but I think that it'll come when the Seahawks are up by more than one score in the third or fourth quarter.
When he's trying to force it? I mean, he didn't make any bad decisions really against Carolina, but against Green Bay, he had a pass that should have been picked off on their final drive. Green Bay should have had the ball with a chance to kick the game-winning field goal and knock the 49ers out of the playoffs, which kind of gets lost when everyone talks about how well the 49ers are coming into this game.
When Colin Kaepernick is forcing it, when he has to throw throws, Colin Kaepernick wants to make a big play.
Yeah.
Colin Kaepernick wants to be
the guy. That's what differentiates him from Alex Smith, I feel like.
And Russell Wilson. He wants to be the guy. He wants to make a big play. And when he's forced to do that, that's when he's going to do something stupid.
I see the Seahawks with a couple of big plays in the play-action game.
Absolutely.
I think that's going to be...
I think that they're going to pass the ball much better than they did last week. And I think Russell Wilson will redeem himself. I think, A, that they're going to win. But also, I think Russell Wilson will redeem himself and change the story going into the Super Bowl.
See, I don't know if that's going to happen because I just don't know if he's going to get enough opportunities to really change the story. But I think the way that Pete Carroll wants to play, and he's talked about this all week, that the first San Francisco game, in his mind, was the perfect football game. Where they threw for like 180 yards.
Yeah.
Like, he's not going to come out there slinging the ball. That's just not in Pete Carroll's DNA. So I think that it's about taking advantages of the two or three opportunities that you do get to make big plays.
I think they'll hit something downfield, which they didn't last week, aside from the Doug Baldwin catch.
I don't know if you can leave that aside since that won the game.
Well, yeah.
People are kind of like, oh, yeah, that the most important play of the game? Yes.
I think they'll hit a big play downfield, and I think it'll be to Jermaine Kearse.
I tend to agree with that. I feel similarly.
Whether it's a touchdown or just a long catch, I think they'll hit Kearse on a big play, and I think the 49ers won't be expecting. He's the person who kind of gets lost in the whole conversation about Percy Harvin, is that Jermaine Kearse is one of the better downfield receivers, I was going to say, in the NFL.
let's not get ahead of ourselves.
He's one of the better downfield receivers on the Seahawks.
The official player of the Pelton cast. But
I think they hit him big. I think Russell does something like 20 of 26, 27 for 250 yards.
Wow. I'll take that. If we can get that, I'll take that right now.
It's going to be an efficient game for Russell where he passes for more yards than he's passed for in a few weeks.
I think something like 12 of 19 for 175 yards and two big plays.
They're going to be so
key into the run. I think the other one is Zach Miller.
I could see Zach Miller or Luke Wilson.
Yeah.
I think they're going to be so keyed into the run and they want to stop the run, especially after what the Seahawks did last week against the Saints, that they're going to be so focused on that. And they know that it's one of their deficiencies. They know that they're worse against the run than they are against the pass. And they're going to be so focused on trying to stop that, that they're going to let things happen downfield a little bit more than they should.
And that's where you need the protection to hold up. Absolutely has to hold up. It did against New Orleans on that Baldwin catch.
And I think the protection was generally pretty good against New Orleans.
It wasn't bad, yeah.
And I think it will hold up in this game. And I think that they'll also have a big play with somebody going against Dante Whitner, who's not that great of a coverage safety. And I think that they'll get a big play downfield against him.
If I can give you one takeaway, any player that refers to themselves as Hittner and wants to change their name to that, probably not that good in coverage.
Yeah. Their safeties are actually really similar to the Seahawks safeties, where you have Eric Reed, who's kind of the Earl Thomas type. He's also a rookie, so not quite as experienced. And then you have Dante Whitner, who's kind of the Cam Chancellor type.
Absolutely.
I mean, the thing is, they just don't have those cornerbacks that the Seahawks have, and I think that's another place that they're going to find. The big play for Kearse will be going against one of their cornerbacks, and it'll just be a jump ball, and Kearse will go up and get it.
Along the red line?
And I think that they'll get one of the tight end plays going against Whitner. I called him Whitner, and I meant Whitner. I didn't mean to call him that.
He just changed his name. Like, you're just getting ahead of the game on that one.
He hasn't changed his name yet.
He hasn't?
I don't think so. I think he wanted to, but decided not to. Decided when the NFL was cutting down on concussions.
No, I think it's because he was told that he couldn't change the name on his jersey until next season.
Oh, really?
Is my understanding, but it's been a while.
That'll be really good for the PR great. Of the NFL. Chances of victory?
60% if Percy Harvin does not play, 65% if Harvin is in the lineup.
I think that they're going to win this game easier than they beat the Saints.
Wow. I hope so.
I think that they're going to win. I don't want to say it'll be easy, but I think that they win by more than two scores. I'm going to say 70% either way, 70% chance.
I see. The way I envision it playing out is a situation where the Seahawks get the ball needing to run out the clock and do so.
Chances of me crying if they lose.
Oh, at least 95%.
100%. Chances of the most depressed walking out of the game that has ever happened.
I mean, just the vision of Jim Harbaugh and the 49ers celebrating in CenturyLink Field is a tough one to contemplate.
I feel like that's enough. It takes the crowd and the players to another level.
It absolutely should.
That's why having Jim Harbaugh be involved in this game and Colin Kaepernick, I think, is a good thing. I'm happy that we're playing the 49ers and not the Panthers, because that extra level that the Seahawks need, they're going to be there from the very beginning.
I mean, I tweeted last week during the game, like, if Carolina wins this game, I don't know how I'm going to summon any dislike of them next week, because I love Carolina.
No, I mean, I was not cheering for Carolina throughout the year, but, like...
Yeah. I was cheering for them, unabashedly so.
They're one of my top five favorite teams. So that was a really good thing. If the Seahawks win this game, so we'll have 2 weeks, right, which I'm excited about. I want to talk about two things. We kind of talked about this earlier, but I want to talk about the Win Forever Pyramid.
Yes.
And its effect on the team. I'm making a little pyramid motion. It's actually a pyramid, not just a triangle, like the actual Win Forever pyramid.
That's good.
And then I also want to talk about the moment that this team started to exist, this current team. So, I have...
I'll start thinking about that, I guess.
A personal story. I know exactly the moment that it was.
Okay.
I know the day and the moment that it was, and a personal story around it. So, I'm excited to talk about that. But let's wrap things up by talking about Husky basketball.
Yeah, so that's, we've got to find some time in our obsession with the Seahawks to note that UW basketball won 2 games last week, now 3-1 in Pac-12 play. Tied, I believe, for 3rd or 4th in the conference.
And their defense is really what drove those victories. I thought they played really well. I didn't get to see the Utah game, but I watched the entire Colorado game. Things changed a little bit when Spencer Dinwiddie, Colorado's star player, went down. Is that confirmed as a torn ACL?
It was confirmed, yes.
Oh, God. The second torn ACL at Bank of America Arena this year.
The 4th ACL tear I've seen in person in the last 12 months. Do not play basketball in front of me, around me. Just don't do it.
You should be, or be you, man. What if you go down with an ACL tear?
Don't think I haven't thought about it.
You think that watching other people get ACL tears means you're more likely to have one?
No, but it's definitely one of those things where, like, anytime someone does it, you get really scared about
what,
it.
What would be the hashtag for that?
No ACLs.
Hashtag no ACLs.
Like the one player.
It's true. But those were both nice victories, and do you want to break down California and Stanford this coming week?
Well, first let's talk about the defense.
So. Even when I'm talking about basketball, I'm talking about football.
Yeah. This is a complete stunning thing because the Huskies could not defend anyone in non-conference, and so far they're 2nd in the Pac-12 in defense on a per possession basis over the first 4 games. And haven't necessarily, I mean, you faced Arizona, so that's, you know, that's a tough enough schedule. Part of it is they've been getting really lucky in terms of opponent 3-point shooting. Opponents so far in conference play have made 12% of their 3-point attempts.
They're defending those threes though. They have hands in those players' faces.
Now, what the Huskies are doing is they're 2nd in terms of allowing teams to attempt 3-pointers. And they're 1 in lowest assist to field goal rate. So those are both good things that indicate that they're not breaking down defensively and getting into rotation. They've done a good job switching screens on the perimeter, taking advantage of the fact that all of their players are relatively similar size. And you can switch basically everything that doesn't involve Paris Blackwell and get away with it. Mm-hmm. So that's been good to them. But you're not going to continue allowing 12% from three. The statistics are overwhelmingly clear that it's just a noise. It's not a skill. So that will even out. And the funny thing is it happened in the first 4 games last year when the Huskies started 4-0 in conference play.
Really? It was really similar? Well, that's frightening.
Eerily similar. Well, I mean, if you consider, I mean, last year they finished 9-9, which is currently their projected record from Ken Pomeroy. If they finish 9-9, I'll take that to the bank all day. I mean, we're 2 weeks removed from they were predicted to finish last. So
then what about the teams that they're playing this coming week?
Cal and Stanford, one of the tougher road trips in the conference. I think probably the Arizona schools at this point are the hardest, but because Arizona is the 1 team in the country and undefeated. Mm-hmm. But two very good teams. Cal at this point is tied for 1st in the Pac-12, off to a great start. Swept the road trip to the Oregon schools last year. They're 3-0, all 3 wins on the road.
Really?
Which is very impressive in conference play. And they've done it without Jabari Bird, their star freshman wing, who has been injured and will be coming back tonight. So,
he will be playing tonight.
Yeah, maybe limited minutes, but that makes them even tougher. They're a very good team, very hard to beat on the road. Stanford is a team that has constantly looked like they're on the cusp of turning it around, and so far they haven't. They've had a really weird Pac-12 season thus far. They lost at home to Cal, lost at Oregon State, which even on the road is a bad loss, and then turn around and beat Oregon on Sunday. So I don't know what to make of that. They've beaten Oregon. They won at UConn, which is one of the more impressive wins by a Pac-12 team all season. And you never know what you're going to get from Stanford on any given night. That game could go either way.
I thought they looked pretty good against Oregon on Sunday.
Yeah, obviously they did. I mean, they're very talented. They should be an NCAA tournament team. And if they're not, which it doesn't look at this point like they're going to be, then Johnny Dawkins is probably going to get fired.
Really? It could be his last year.
He's on the hot seat.
So you think that the 3-point shooting, that they'll give up more than for these coming 2 games? Ah.
Yes. I mean, I think it'll be like a 35%, 34%, whatever is average. It'll be closer to that. And that's, you're talking about, 3 or 4 shots a game, and that's like 9 points. And it's enough to turn a couple of these close wins and swing them to losses.
What about offensively for the Huskies?
They've actually kind of struggled a little bit in conference play. They're 9th in, or 8th in scoring on a per-possession basis. They've been really heavily dependent on C.J. Wilcox, obviously, and he's played extraordinarily well. Had the best all-around game of his career on Sunday against Colorado.
It was really exciting to see him have a breakout game. You hope that continues this week.
Yeah, but if teams can take him away, then it gets a little more difficult. Nigel Williams-Goss is playing pretty well in conference play so far, and Andrew Andrews is a solid contributor on the perimeter, but they just don't have a ton of outside shooting if Wilcox isn't on.
What about the Huskies' big men? I mean, I think I'm a fan of Paris Blackwell. It seems like he's playing pretty well, but beyond that, it's real ugly.
Yeah, I mean, they're limited depth. Sean Kemp's played a little better lately. He's still struggling a lot with foul trouble. Desmond Simmons has helped at times. He was very big in that Utah
game. Do you think
he's
just working himself back into playing shape?
Simmons?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he'll get better over the course of this. We've seen it in bits and spurts, but the Huskies also have played really well with Mike Anderson in that power forward position. That's a tougher lineup to defend on the perimeter, mm-hmm. and he's very good on the glass.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the best option for a team that doesn't have a lot of size, is to go with a good shooter at power forward and be able to spread out the defense.
He's a good matchup for a lot of the stretch fours in the conference, and then also allows you to switch, like we talked about earlier.
And it seems like it'll give CJ more open shots, too, if you can work the ball around potentially against a zone.
Yes.
Chances of winning one, two, both of these games? Zero, one, or two?
The most likely outcome by far is winning zero of these games. Mm-hmm. I would say that probably is, like, you know, two-thirds of the time.
Really?
It's a really tough one. And two is, like, winning both of them, like, 5%.
Really?
If they do that, all of a sudden, the conversation about this team changes dramatically.
So you're predicting that they win zero?
Yes.
Chances of winning one is 33%?
It's, like, 28, I think. It's whatever's left over in the one-third.
I think they'll win a game.
You're more optimistic than I am. I mean, I'm still going by the fact that overall their performance has not been very good.
I mean, last week you predicted that they wouldn't win either of those two games.
I said they were not likely to win either.
They were not likely to win either of the two games, and they ended up winning both and played pretty well.
I mean, the Utah game went about as expected. I said 45% chance of winning. They won by two. I mean, they pulled away a little bit and should have had an easier victory at the end of that. But the Colorado game was the surprise, and it's just tough to say how much of that was Dinwiddie's injury. They were behind, but they were playing very well defensively before Dinwiddie got hurt.
Interesting. Well, I guess we'll see what happens tonight.
Yeah, we'll know a lot more about this team next week, I think.
Awesome. And we'll know a lot more about how happy or sad we are next week.
We will know a great deal more. It could be the saddest podcast. It could be the happiest podcast. It's always 50-50.
Yeah. Oh, man.
All right. Well, thanks for listening.
Thank
go
you.
Hawks.